Welcome back, everyone. It's Wednesday, July 27th, 2011. This is BadQuaker.com podcast. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
And fortunately, we got some good feedback from last week's podcast. We stretched it out to an hour. And so far, the feedback has been 100% to stay at the hour rather than trying to shrink it in and cram it all into half an hour. So we're going to take up your time for an hour again today. If you don't like that, let us know. We're not necessarily a democracy. but we
do like to, please our consumers.
There you go. So. Yes. A couple of topics that we wanted to touch on today is the wildly popular trend towards steampunk. If you don't know what steampunk is, hang in there. We're going to cover it. If, after talking about steampunk, if we have any time left over, we might go into a couple other things. But we could really talk about steampunk for like 20 hours. Not because either of us is wildly into steampunk. It's just that there's so much there. It's such a huge thing.
Right.
So if you don't know about steampunk or you're not into it, don't turn away just yet. You might find some interesting stuff there. Like I said, I'm not into steampunk really, but there's some interesting imagery and things like that.
I'm into steampunk because the people who are into steampunk are willing to spend a lot of money on steampunk stuff.
So
we made a lot of money off the steampunk stuff.
Really? At the Ren?
At the Ren Fair. Which, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, but that was the first place I was introduced to steampunk, was the Ren Fair.
So people go to a place themed in the, like, 1600s, and they buy steampunk stuff, which is futuristic, Victorian projection.
It's funnier than that, because... Okay, so there's this whole running joke at the Renaissance Festival, because all the Renaissance festivals you go to are set in England, and there was no Renaissance in England.
Right, right.
There was the Reformation, but nobody wants to go to a Reformation festival. That's really not fun. So you have a Renaissance festival being set in the Reformation to begin with. And then you get people who come dressed in sort of this weird mixture of Renaissance, Victorian, modern... It's really weird.
With Spock ears.
Yes.
Or Hobbit feet.
I've seen a steampunk Darth Vader.
Oh, no.
It was pretty awesome.
At a Renaissance festival. Oh, man. If we get time, because we're not actually talking about steampunk yet, if we get time, we might go into a couple other items. We talked about last week some of Kai's experiences in life and kind of who she is and where she came from and things like that. And we might touch on some of that stuff for me today if we get around in that direction. Or we might go back in the direction of talking more about Kai, because just like what you just heard, she had a very interesting life on the Renaissance Festival circuits. So we might go in any of those directions. We haven't really scripted out that part. I do have a ton of notes on not really on steampunk, but on what might have been or what could have been to have created a world that really would be something kind of like what the steampunk movement is.
It's very interesting because that time period, right sort of during the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, right after the time period of the Victorian Age, I think the world was closer at that point to anarchy.
Yes.
Than it had been in centuries.
On that specific topic, let me just take in one direction and just make this statement. If it weren't in between 1840 and 1860, the governments, mostly England and the United States, but others were going in that direction as well, began creating the modern corporation. They moved away from, the state moved away from supporting mercantilism and moved towards supporting corporatism. Now, mercantilism was the market controlled by the state.
Right.
But industry was taking off so fast and businesses were exploding so fast that the states could not control them. And by states and state, I'm talking about the entity, not individual states like Connecticut.
Right.
And not necessarily individual states like Great Britain or the United States, but the state as the greater entity, influence in the world. The state could not contain business in the mid-1800s. So in order to, because it was losing control through the mercantile system, the state abandoned the mercantile system and adopted corporations, and then used its muscle to crush business and force them either into the corporation mold or always subservient to the corporation mold.
Mm-hmm.
Because the state cannot allow the existence of a free market and a non-corporation business, because that will destroy the state.
Right.
The free market will destroy the state. So the state has to have, in order for the state to function in its modern sense, it has to have the corporation. And for the corporation to exist, it has to have the muscle of the state. The two cannot function without each other. They are like the shark with the little fish that swim around in its mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The shark would die of infection if it weren't for the little fish. The little fish would get eaten by big fish if it weren't for the shark.
Right.
That's exactly this situation. You have the muscle of the state and the dependency of corporations on that muscle and the dependency of the state on the financing of the corporations.
And we had a brief period there in the early, the late 1800s,
mm-hmm.
where the state had not begun to enforce its corporations yet.
Yeah.
And there was really a chance that the free market could just out-produce the functions of the state.
One of the ways the state grasped control was in 1890, in the United States, Congress passed the Sherman Act. And the Sherman Act was almost entirely directed at a few small, they were small segments of the overall business community.
Mm-hmm.
But they were some big business giants, guys like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, people like that who had scratched out of nothing, had created whole industries and whole businesses.
And they were not corporations.
They were not corporations. J.D. Rockefeller ran a trust, and Andrew Carnegie had a limited partnership. And so the states could not control people like this.
Right.
So the states had to break those organizations up.
And that type of organization is preferable to a corporation in that if something happens, if the Carnegie group
mm-hmm.
was at fault for something.
Yeah.
Andrew Carnegie was the person who was responsible for it.
Yeah. The company had a man,
right.
A person, a human, could be a woman, but Andrew Carnegie was not a woman.
Right.
But there were big businesses that were, that's a different topic.
But the point is, there is a single person at the head.
Right.
Or who is
responsible.
A group of people, but there are human beings who are responsible for that company.
Right. And if that company does something wrong, those human beings can be held responsible. The corporation, on the other hand, like the state, is a make-believe entity that has no one responsible for its actions.
This is why it's called a limited liability corporation.
Yeah. Okay, so now that we've got that out of the way, and we realize that it was the formation of the corporations that allowed the state to take over worldwide in the late 1800s and created all the mess of the 20th century, so what's that got to do with steampunk? Well, steampunk, an aspect of steampunk, is if you can imagine, let's just pick a year, it could be 1880, 1890, 1900, whatever, sometime in the Victorian age, if the fascination for oil-driven energy if we had not taken that thread of history and gone down that path.
State-influenced obsession with oil.
Yeah, and I'll touch on that in a minute, but that's exactly what happened. The state and the corporations took us in the oil direction and away from the steam direction. If we had stayed in the direction of steam, what would society look like? And steampunk answers that question. Not with one answer, but with as many answers as there are people who are fans of steampunk. Mm-hmm. And that's really the wonders of the market, is that it's not based on one person, but it's based on a dynamic thing that exists out there, the exact opposite of the state, the exact opposite of corporations. Mm-hmm. It is a magical thing that moves and drives and brings freedom and brings wealth to people, unlike the state. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so steampunk. So some examples of steampunk. Think of Jules Verne. Think of the wild, crazy ideas that he came up with.
Yep.
That's the direction of steampunk. If you think of the old TV show Wild Wild West, interesting gadgets that never really existed. If you think of the remake of the Wild Wild West, which was a movie and starring...
Will Smith
and the other guy.
Klein.
Yeah. if you think of that movie and the bizarre contraptions that they used in that movie, that's steampunk. That's the direction of steampunk. If you think of, if you're familiar with the movie Brazil from 1985, or there was a short-lived TV show called The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. that kind of went in that direction. I'm not so familiar with the genre that I can speak as to, you know, what is the best or the best example or whatever, but maybe one of the best known examples was the movie The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. All the the gadgetry. I'm blending words. I'm making up my own words. Hey, we're not under a king or a queen over here in America. We can make up our own words anytime we want.
That's right. Just ask our president.
Well, our last one. The current one is not so... I don't know if he makes up words or not. Anyway, so that's what we're talking about, steampunk. We're talking about a world not based on the oil industry.
Right.
And how could we have a world not based on the oil industry? Well, a couple things. Let's take that moment in time, 1890, I believe it was. Yeah, 1890. I actually have notes on this. we look at 1890, and we look at the Sherman Act. In the United States, when the Sherman Act was passed, nothing happened. The state did not use the Sherman Act for the purpose that it was passed. It just sat there. And the reason why is because if you were a politician in 1890 and you decided to use the Sherman Act to, let's say, attack a big businessman like Andrew Carnegie or J.D. Rockefeller, things may not be so happy for you.
Yeah, when you have the state trying to... When you have the state at odds with the rich...
Yeah.
What often happens is the state finds itself not existing anymore, or not existing in that incarnation, at least.
Yeah. But with the Sherman Act, it took a very special man to come in and pick up the Sherman Act and use it basically as a big old hammer and just beat Andrew Carnegie and J.D. Rockefeller, just beat them senseless.
Someone who had a lot of wealth to begin with.
Someone who had absolutely no fear of anything.
Right.
And that was Teddy Roosevelt. And if I'm going to talk about a president, and it doesn't matter which president I'm talking about, the odds are you're going to hear me say some very derogatory things about that individual if I know anything about him.
Right.
Because generally speaking, if someone has what it takes to want to be the president of the United States, I have a real question about their honesty.
Right.
And
anyone who wants to be president probably oughtn't be president.
Tolkien had a statement about that. I wish I had that to where I could read it. But he essentially said... He said, first off, he said it's an insult to the English language to use the word government with a capital G.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not a person. And so you know, it should not be given that that crown of making a person out of it.
Right.
And then he said, and anyone who, basically he said, anyone who would want to be in charge of government probably shouldn't be allowed.
Right.
You know, but anyway, I don't have the exact quote, but anyway, so Teddy Roosevelt, I'm wandering. I'll try not to wander. That's like, okay. Anyway.
Let me wonder about why I'm wondering.
So Teddy Roosevelt, if I'm talking about any particular president and I'm beating him up, it's probably because despite. I always get confused by that. Either way, the state creates a magical image of presidents. And those magical images are 99.9% false.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who would become president, who has to do everything it takes to become a president, is probably somebody who needs to be thrown out of the presidency.
Right.
There might be exceptions, but that's a general rule that you're safe by going by. And Teddy, go ahead.
And I just wanted to put out, the myth that anybody can become president is a total lie. You cannot become president without lots and lots and lots of money.
Yes, I'm sorry, Junior, or you know, young daughter. I'm sorry, you're not going to be president. You would have to be a lot more evil than you are.
Yeah.
But
and make friends with people who are really, really rich and really, really evil.
Yeah. So Teddy Roosevelt was an interesting character. He was a man's man. He really did amazing things. He, you know, just as a rich kid, he just took off out into the West on his own without his bodyguards and without the protection of his rich family, without his daddy's money. He just took off out there with a rifle, and he actually did this stuff. He was amazing. But he was also nuts.
Right.
He was a self-centered jerk. He would beat people up because he felt like it. And then he would mock them if they didn't defend themselves. But he was a man of fantastic bravery.
Mm-hmm.
He was the point of an attempted assassination. He was shot in the chest in the middle of a speech and finished the speech.
Right. He's an interesting character because you don't find many brave bullies.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And he'd probably admit to that if he were sitting here. He was a brave bully, and that's a rare commodity.
And not a good one.
Like, no.
You don't really want brave bullies.
If you think in that realm, you might think of like a Fonzie character.
Yeah.
But he wasn't like a Fonzie character. He was more like Mussolini.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if Mussolini was a bit braver and shorter. And could box.
Right.
Because Teddy Roosevelt could box. Teddy Roosevelt went so far as to interfere with football. Teddy Roosevelt couldn't let well enough alone and had to interfere with football. Now, I know he's credited with inventing the pass or whatever. Well, that's not really true. I'm not going to get into that whole story right now. But he, as a president, where in the Constitution does it tell that the President of the United States can change the rules of a game that colleges play?
Right.
It doesn't say that.
Right.
And yet he did that.
Yep.
He used his power as the president to force colleges to change the rules of football.
Because he was old money. He was
That's
rich,
the key.
And from the time he was born, he was capable of doing whatever he wanted to do. And there was no fear. We see what happens with someone. Let's take Teddy Roosevelt versus Andrew Carnegie.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Carnegie was born poor.
Right.
And he scratched out a living to where he became very wealthy.
Right.
But there was always this fear that that wealth is going to go away.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's a risk.
Right.
When you
in business, you take wealth, risks.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
When you create wealth through business,
mm-hmm.
there's always this risk that it's going to go away.
Yeah.
So you can't take those super high risks
mm-hmm.
and just be careless with your money because you worked for that money.
Exactly.
It means something to you.
But when you inherit more money than you can possibly throw away in your lifetime, mm-hmm. you have a whole different view of this.
Yep.
And that's who Teddy Roosevelt was. He had no fear of business. He had no fear of the voters. He had no fear of government.
Yep.
He could just stomp right on and do whatever he wanted. So Teddy Roosevelt picked up the Sherman Act and beat business into submission and allowed the corporations to take their present position.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned the risk that a businessman takes. Let me bring up another businessman. There was a guy named Fisher. It might take me a second. Oh, Carl Fisher. There was a guy named Carl Fisher. And he was around in the same, roughly the same time frame as Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not sure exactly how their ages would coincide, but he was. They were contemporaries. Carl Fisher was from a fairly wealthy family, not anything comparable to the Roosevelts, but...
Right.
But there was some family wealth there. And so in the late 1800s, he got into the very trendy bicycle movement, which was in the late 1800s and early 1900s, even when cars started to become more and more common, a proper rich person, a person of family wealth, a person of old money, oftentimes didn't have a car
right.
because that was a dirty thing that those new rich liked.
Right.
So there was this class distinction between the new rich and the old money. The new rich wanted to be like old money, but they weren't. They tended to spend their money on goofy things like bicycles.
Right.
And bicycles were expensive luxury item, and they were very trendy in the late 1800s. Carl Fisher was a bicyclist, and then his family wealth started to fall off a little bit, so he started, much like the Wright brothers we talked about before,
mm-hmm.
he set up his own bicycle shop. He could finance himself in his hobby with his bicycle shop.
Right.
But as automobiles started to catch on, Fisher got fascinated with automobiles, and so he switched his bicycle shop to making automotive parts.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a pretty nice little business making automotive parts. And when his automotive part business got big enough, he sold it.
Right.
And I think he made, this is at or around 1910 or something. I'm not sure exactly when he sold his auto part business. But when he sold it, I think he made something like $9 million out of
his
auto parts business.
Was a lot.
In those days, $9 million was considered a lot of money.
Right.
That's actually a line from the first, Arthur, the movie Arthur. That was a line, Arthur loses a bunch of money and he says something like, I lost $5 million. That's when $5 million was considered a lot of money. Anyway, So Carl Fisher sells his auto parts business for $9 million. He's in Indianapolis. So he then sets up a car dealership. He was one of the early car dealerships, and he's selling cars because he's fascinated with them.
Right.
And he's making money off of it. But to promote his cars, he decides to make a racetrack, an automotive racetrack. Now, there were bicycle racetracks. These were a big deal
right.
around the turn of that century. Bicycle racetracks were a big deal. But he made an automotive racetrack. The problem is, it was extremely dangerous.
Right.
And there was a horrific crash that was heavily publicized, and he took a lot of heat over this very, very heavily publicized crash.
Right.
So he got the idea. Well, we need a safer racetrack, so we will pave the racetrack with pavers, bricks.
Right.
Thus, the Brickyard was mm-hmm. born, where the Indianapolis 500 is held. Fisher made so much money from the sale of his auto parts company, and then later from his involvement in the auto industry and selling cars, that he decided this paving thing was a good idea, and it was a good what he wanted to do was connect Indianapolis, and he was one of these people that really loved his hometown. He wanted to connect it to bigger cities so that there would be more business.
Right.
And with more business, more people would be richer, and more people would buy cars, and he would be richer.
Right.
So he first started with a highway.
Because that's the great thing about capitalism, is that capitalism embraces charity and also makes money off of it.
Yeah. And it makes everybody. what's his name? Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, made the statement that rising economy floats all boats.
Right.
Everybody goes up at the same time, and that's what the free market does. It increases the wealth of everybody, not just the super rich. Corporations, on the other hand, work the workers at a set wage, while the big investors in the corporation make big money.
Yep.
That's just the opposite of capitalism.
Yep.
That's fascism. We haven't done that one in a while. Okay, so I'll try to get through. I'm walking all around steampunk, but I'm not stepping on it. So Fisher now has a lot of money from the auto industry.
Right.
And so Fisher wants more business, and he wants more business in Indianapolis. And he sees the advantage that he would have if there was some way to get in a car and drive from New York to Indianapolis.
Right.
So Fisher built a highway, a private highway. Now, he didn't just pull out the money out of his pocket. He wasn't that. He was smarter than that.
Right.
What he did was he would go from town to town to town. And he would say to one town, you know, he would say he would have a meeting of businessmen from that town. And he would say, you know, if the road was improved from your town to the next town over, some of those folks over there would drive over here and buy what you've got.
Right.
And also, there's a big town that's over there a little bit further. Folks from that big town might drive past your town to get to this other big town. And while they're driving through your town, they may want to stop and get lunch.
Right.
Or they may have to fill up their gas tank on their new automobile.
Right.
And when they do that, they'll be doing that in your town. So business people in individual towns invested in this new highway.
Right.
And Fisher did this and privately built a highway that went all the way from New York City all the way to Indianapolis. And he did it so quick and so successfully and so profitably that he continued and went all the way to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Then, amazed at how fast he accomplished this deed, all privately, he started again. He decided, you know what, in Indianapolis, the winters are kind of nasty. And maybe some of us here in Indianapolis would like to leave in the winter.
Right.
And a nice place to be would be Miami, Florida. So he built a highway from Miami, Florida to Indianapolis, and he called it the Dixie Highway. And he did it so quick, again, and so profitable, that he decided, you know, I'll bet there's people in Canada who would like to go to Miami for the winter. And so he built the road all the way from Indianapolis to Canada.
He's the one who's responsible for all those Canadians in Florida.
We love our Canadian audience. We actually have quite a few people in Canada that listen, so we love our Canadian. Please come to Florida. Well, actually, we're in Ohio, so yeah, go to Florida. And keep the Floridians down there. For some reason, they want to drive to Canada.
So what you're saying is he built these roads, these private, non-government roads.
Mm-hmm. From coast to coast.
They were toll roads, right? You had to pay a toll to drive on them.
No toll at all. Anywhere in the road, there was no toll at all. It was all free for the user. It was all paid for by merchants, voluntarily, and it was all profitable. Pretty good, huh? Good, too good.
Better than what the government can do, considering the government can't even keep the roads in working order right now when they steal the money to do it.
Yeah, and they have armies of construction workers constantly working on it. Now, he actually did do too good of a job. Let me back the story up just a little bit to bicycles again. The bicycle people didn't really appreciate Fisher abandoning them.
Right.
There were the bicycle people, and there were the car people. Now, the car people wanted roads, but if you think about, say, let's just pick a time frame, let's say 1910. If you think about the kind of a road a car person would want, and then compare that to the kind of a road a bicycle person would want,
mm-hmm.
We're not talking about the same road.
No.
So, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, there was a thing called the Good Roads Movement, and this was pushed by the bicyclers. Now, keep in mind, the bicyclers are part of this new wealth, this new upper middle class that was that had just recently, because of the burst of the industry of industries and because of the burst of the market, people, families who had never had wealth before suddenly found themselves very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of things with their money. They built beautiful Victorian homes, elaborate artistry on these homes. If you think about pretty much everything, the style of clothing from the 1880s to 1900, it was all just very over the top with colors and very vibrant.
And there was a new wealth class, there was the middle class that had just come about.
Right.
And suddenly you had people who were not necessarily rich, but they could afford to have nice things.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't in...
They weren't scratching the ground anymore. You think of that imagery in Monty Python's Holy Grail, where the person is sitting down there and there's some nice mud over here, you know. They're scratching around. Oh, a worm, you know.
Yeah.
They were able to pull themselves out of that, and they were actually doing pretty good. And the better, higher income of those people were the bicyclers. They were not old money; they were new money, but they were rich, and they wanted bicycling to be promoted. And oddly enough, a good portion of them were progressives.
And this, there was this whole movement in there right around this whole time that was kind of the Kellogg movement.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
This progressive, health, vegan,
yeah.
Super high grain.
There was a lot of exercising and exercise machines being developed that had never existed before.
And
some of them were pretty goofy.
And this was that entire, all of these movements were kind of intertwined
all happening at the same time. The bicycle.
Because really, you got to kind of be a little bit rich in order to really care about stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you're just trying to make enough money to feed your family.
Yeah.
You really don't care about,
you
know, exercising and stuff like that. That is a strictly modern overabundance of wealth and time on your hands.
Yeah, you take a look at the picture of the, well, it's not a picture, but it's a painting. And it was contemporary. It was contemporary to the day, the painting of the guys supposedly signing the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
There are not a lot of fat people in that. Mm-hmm. You don't see a lot of robust. They're not rotund.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the bicycle movement was really taken off, and it was the rich. And they were exclusive. They did not appreciate the poor people, and they did not appreciate these automobile people.
Right.
And so they wanted highways built for bicycles. They did not want highways built for cars. They had no desire to go in that direction whatsoever.
Right.
The Good Roads Movement was a tool that the bicyclers used to try to drum up support to get the government to use its force and take control of roads. The problem is, you know, it's like the government is in many ways, and I'll make this argument at some point in time, but not today. The government in many ways is like Pandora's box. You don't know what you're going to get when you open that thing up.
Right.
If you knew what was in there, you wouldn't have opened it.
Right.
But the desire to think, oh, I can use this for good, and so you open it. And when you open it, you lose control of it. And
right.
That's what the government does. And that's what the Good Roads Movement did. They opened up the Pandora's box of using their influence to get the government to get involved in roads. The problem was, it was against the law for the federal government to influence roads.
Right.
It was actually against the law, because people understood that it's not within the Constitution. The federal government has no authority to influence roads in any way.
And there were people like Fisher who were making a lot of money off the roads.
Which makes the government jealous.
Right. But it also makes those people not want the government to come in and take over those roads.
Right.
Because you were making a lot of money off of it.
Right. In 1909, I think? 1907. In 1907, the Supreme Court made a judgment on a case called Wilson versus Shaw. And the Supreme Court used the Notorious Commerce Clause in that decision to say that, in fact, the federal government could fund highways. And so the Good Roads people leapt for joy.
Yeah.
They were so happy because now they can use the fist of government to get their precious roads built for their bicycles. And did that work?
Mm,
not so much.
Not so much.
No, because the government's lazy too.
Which, you know, it's kind of funny. One of the, just here in this particular town that we're in right now, is home to the Wrights.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Wright
family.
Family
of
sure.
progressives yeah, who are really into the bicycle movement.
We have the Wright House is the oldest house in town, I believe.
And do we have bicycle lanes in this town?
There might be one, but I doubt if it goes more than a couple blocks.
Yeah. No. It's actually kind of dangerous to ride your bike on the roads.
It's very dangerous
here.
In this town to try to ride a bike in this town. Very dangerous. Some places there's no shoulder at all.
Yeah.
And you're just dumped right into first there's a shoulder, then there's no shoulder, and you're just dumped right into traffic.
Yep.
Very bad. So, 1907, the Supreme Court just invents a way to translate the Commerce Clause that allows the federal government to subsidize roads or to spend money on roads.
Which is why the Constitution doesn't work, because you're asking the people who want to do something to interpret the law that they wrote in order to do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It can't work.
Asking the state to cross-check the state is like, you know...
Really? You found a loophole that makes you able to do that? I would have never guessed that.
By the way, the Commerce Clause, in case that sounds familiar, but they don't quite place what it is. The Commerce Clause is the one that allows them to, arrest a guy for growing wheat on his own farm that he fed to his own cattle because they used the Commerce Clause to say, well, you grew that wheat without our permission, and if you hadn't grown that wheat, you would have bought wheat that may have crossed a state line, therefore the Commerce Clause covers it, and you're under arrest for growing wheat. Or, you're under arrest for selling milk because of the Commerce Clause.
Right.
Or, you can't grow this particular plant that makes rope, specifically,
Hemp.
Hemp. I couldn't remember. You can't grow hemp because of the Commerce Clause. Therefore, you can't possess marijuana because of the Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
You can't do this because of the Commerce Clause. You can't do that because of the... As a matter of fact, we can use, speaking as the state, we can use the Commerce Clause to do anything we want.
Yep.
What a wonderful constitution. If we could just be constitutional.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, I'm walking all around steampunk and not stepping on it. So what does all this have to do with steampunk? Well, stick with me here. So in 1907, the government now is authorized by the Supreme Court to get its big, fat, ugly, wart-covered nose into roads and road construction.
Yes.
Isn't that going to turn out lovely?
Yes.
So even though Fisher had done such a good job of building roads, the state, the first attempt to socialize the roads was the Federal Aid Road Act of 1916, signed by the wonderful Woodrow Wilson. And if you've heard me ever...
There's a man in history that I'd love to go back and just kick in the teeth.
If you've ever heard me talk about the wonders of Woodrow Wilson, you'll know why I say his name like that. So the Federal Aid Road Act, doesn't that sound wonderful? Doesn't that sound charitable? Doesn't that...
They're going to aid you.
Yeah, oh, it's going to be great. But actually it was more like AIDS. It's a death sentence to free highways.
Yes.
So the Aid Road Act of 1916 was the first real attempt to socialize highways in the United States. And it didn't really have the teeth that the state needed. It couldn't really accomplish the goal. So by 1926, they came up with a new version. It seemed in 1926 that there were so many highways being built in so many directions by so many different private companies that it was getting confusing. And so if there were only a numbering system, if we could number the roads in a way, then organize them, you see? And so it was sold to the public. What we need to do is we need to have an act of Congress that numbers all these roads so that people can know where they're going.
I knew it. I knew. Math is a tool of the state. Numbers are a tool of the state.
Well, you wouldn't think so considering the current budget mess, but... So in 1926, the United States Congress passed the United States Numbered Highway System Act. Now that sounds pretty harmless. We're just going to know, it's just numbers. We're just going to count. We're just numbering them.
What could possibly go wrong?
Here's a general rule of thumb. If you can count something and name it, the odds are you own it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did.
Because there's no point in taking inventory of something if you don't own it.
Right. And the authority to name something is directly related to the authority of ownership.
Yeah.
So the United States government, in this harmless-sounding act, the numbered highways system, seized ownership of the highways. Mm-hmm. They socialized the highways through confiscation.
And it's an interesting thing because right around this time frame, you had this war where they were very interested in making engines that ran off petroleum products.
Absolutely.
They also went and invaded an area that had a lot of petroleum products. And they removed the states, the governments that were there, mm-hmm. and put in puppet governments that they could control.
Exactly. This at the same time in history that legitimate businesses like Standard Oil were broken up and forced to become corporations, mm-hmm. at the same time, companies like British Petroleum, which were at that time purely government-owned, formed. So the oil industry went out of private hands and into the corporate and the government world.
Yep. And it's interesting because at this time, cars were not set. Like, they were not, this is how a car runs.
Yeah, exactly.
It was tinkerers and people and individual companies that were all making cars mm-hmm. in unique and interesting ways.
In the first 30 years of the automotive age, there were steam cars, there were electric cars, there were cars that ran off gasification, mm-hmm. there were petroleum-based cars, there was a wide variety of vehicles. But when World War I broke out, the involved states took their massive influence, their checkbooks, and their force, and their industry, and they gave a preference to two aspects of industry. One being the internal combustion engine, which runs primarily off of petroleum products, mm-hmm. and two, the petroleum industry itself. Now, I'm not saying there would be no oil if it weren't for the state. What I'm saying is the state usurped itself and came in and took over an industry.
Right.
Through corporations and directly through state-owned companies, the oil industry was captured out of the free market in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
And given preference.
Yes.
Because money was stolen mm-hmm. from the general population and given to these corporations and said, you know, develop this.
And with corporation comes no responsibility for action.
Yep.
Now, when a company like John Rockefeller's Standard Oil, the way it used to be, if it did harm, it was responsible and John Rockefeller was responsible.
Yep.
But when British Petroleum has an oil leak in the middle of the Saudi desert in 1925 or whatever, Who cares?
Yeah.
Who? So what? What are you going to do?
Right.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, they couldn't do that, of course, until they had control of the corporations and control of that chunk of sand in Saudi Arabia. And how did they do that? Well, what you mentioned a second ago was the crushing of a 500-year-old empire, the Ottoman Empire, that had held relative stability in the whole region for 500 years.
Not that we're saying the Ottoman Empire was great. It was a state. You don't want a state, but...
But it was stable. As states go, it was a stable empire in the sense that, you know, it had some problems with Russia, it had some problems with Greece. It wasn't good. I'm not saying the Ottoman Empire was good, but I'm saying it was stable. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying there was relative peace in the Middle East. And there were no radical Muslims in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It was a relatively calm area. Any problems that came up were strictly tribal, and they were settled in very calm ways compared to today.
Right.
So that all changed at the end of World War I.
And also, you know, it was none of our business.
It was absolutely none of our business.
And because it was none of our business, they didn't care about us.
Yeah. They did not, you know, hate us because of our freedom. They don't now, but that's, you know. Okay, so at the end of World War I, there was a French map maker and an English map maker that sat down with a map of the Middle East, and they just took rulers. And all you have to do is go to Google Earth or any map that you might have that you can pull up the Middle East and look at the borders of countries like Iran and Iraq and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Sudan and Chad. Look at the borders of those countries and ask yourself, do those look like natural borders? Not in the least. Those are straight lines drawn on a map with a pen or a pencil, by a French and an English map makers employed by the French and English governments with the muscle of the U.S. behind them to enforce made-up borders in made-up countries with puppet rulers.
Yep.
And that's what we installed into the Middle East and across North Africa after World War I. This allowed these oil companies to go in and run roughshod over the peasantry.
Yep.
And we propped up people like the Royal Saudi family. As a matter of fact, were they Royal Saudi family before we propped them up at the end of World War I? Not in the least. It was a family that had the Saudi family. Well, here you go. Look at the movie sometime when it's on the old movie channel. What's that called? Turner Classic Movies? Is that what it is? TCM. When the movie Lawrence of Arabia plays, take a look at that. It's fairly accurate for a Hollywood movie.
Right.
The so-called prince of Saudi Arabia was not the prince. It wasn't Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
It was Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudi family was not that powerful. Mm-mm. Until the British gave them Arabia, took family members, installed them in Syria, installed them in Lebanon, installed them in the newly created Iraq.
And also made them heads of corporations owning specific oil companies.
Yeah, so that their wealth was so far beyond what the peasantry had that the peasants had no possible way to ever catch back up.
Yep.
And if you notice, there was no Industrial Revolution there. It bypassed them.
Yep.
The common people never got to take part in that, because the state moved in one fell swoop like that on top of them.
Yep.
So how does this have to do with steampunk?
Well, because the idea of steampunk is you take, you know, this timeline and you draw a line off of it and say, at this point, if something had happened, what would it have been like now?
Right.
So bypassing the fascination with oil that happened because of the interference of the state, this interference with oil created the plastic industry.
It created the history that we know.
Yeah, it created the throwaway industry that we have now because of the plastic industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say, okay, going backwards, if that hadn't have happened, mm-hmm. what would have happened?
Steam, let me just say this about Steam. I used to be in, I used to be a Steam engineer. Stationary Steam Engineering is what the my classes and my education, everything, how I got into the engineering industry to begin with was through stationary steam engineering. Steam is amazing. When you look at a pot of boiling water on your stove, you're not looking at steam. You're looking at water vapor. Mm-hmm. True steam is invisible. Water expands, I think it's like, I can't even remember. It's been so many years since I did this. But the expansion of water when it goes from its liquid state to its true gas state, not the vapor state in between, mm-hmm. but the true gas state. The amount of expansion that takes place and the energy that is available when that happens is phenomenal. If you ask the average person, we did this exercise earlier today. You ask the average person, what's the modern way of creating electricity? Now, some people might say solar, but those people are wrong.
Right.
Because as we stand right now, the overall... The amount of energy it takes to create a solar panel, the solar panel will never live long enough and produce enough energy to make up for that.
Right.
This is a government-subsidized industry that is not self-supporting.
Right.
It would die tomorrow if there were no government subsidies.
Right.
So electrical generation through the use of... what are those solar cells called? But anyway, you know what I mean.
Right.
Solar is not an efficient means of getting electricity. Then the next thing you think of was, well, the most modern, I suppose, would be the nuclear power plant.
Right.
That uses steam.
Right.
Where you get the heat from doesn't matter.
Right.
In a atomic reaction, you have heat as one of the byproducts. And so they use that heat to boil water. And the boiling water, the steam, the superheated water, is used to drive turbines that make the electricity.
Right.
So we can have the magic of steam, and anything that we use to create it gives us this unbelievably useful source
right.
of functionality.
Right.
So then if we take the oil industry out, if the market itself were allowed to make choices, and if corporations never grasped control of the oil industry, and if the state had never had its tentacles in the oil industry, and if the state had never had its nasty World War I and pumped all the money that it pumped into the gasoline, into the petroleum-based engine, because the diesel mm-hmm. as well as the gasoline, If the governments of the world had not pumped money into that industry, cars, as we know them, may or may not have ever caught on.
Right.
There are so many alternatives that you may not need cars. Or perhaps there would be cars that ran off of gasification
right.
or electricity or steam or any number of other options. But you wouldn't necessarily have had them running off of petroleum products.
Right.
And so now we have steampunk. Now we have a whole thread of history.
And there's this addition to that, which is because you don't go into the throwaway age. You stay with the age where, you know, you are building beautiful things. Then suddenly you have things that are based on not only their function,
uh-huh.
but their appearance as well.
Yeah. You know, and here's the perfect example of that. Architecture. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier about the opulence of the Gilded Age and the Victorian houses, the beauty and the dress, the way that people dressed back then, and it was just so colorful and dramatic, and it just went in every direction. It was so great. Now, you take a look at, well, what does the state produce for in the realm of construction in architecture?
Gray boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at Soviet buildings, look at East German apartment complexes. Look at housing in that's mostly now been torn down in Chicago and New York City.
Yep.
Look at government housing projects there. They're ugly, they're square, they're boxy, they're wretched to look at, and they don't work good.
Right.
That's what the government produces. Well, so where would society be if you took the freedom of the Industrial Revolution and the beauty of the Gilded Age and the Victorian artistry, and you just let that continue to flow? Where would that have taken?
Yep.
And that's steampunk.
So, interestingly, steampunk is an expression of an alternate reality that could only come about through anarchism.
Yep. Through the loss of the state and the freedom of the individuals.
Yep.
Wow. Well, I guess we don't have any time to talk about anything else.
It's such an interesting time period.
Yeah.
It really is, because humanity was so close to not government.
Yeah. But, on the other hand...
It wasn't ready.
Exactly. It wasn't ready. For several reasons. We'll try to cover this real quick, because we are getting close on time. First off, anarchism, as a theory, as a functional theory, hadn't fully developed yet.
Mm-hmm.
Mises had not explained, well, he was right in that time frame explaining how economics works, but he hadn't caught on yet. And Rothbard had not been born yet to express these things and show us exactly how it could function. Hans Hermann Hoppe was not around to fill in the details of what Murray couldn't figure out on his own. Stefan Molyneux was not there yet to write those books.
So you don't have, you know, this inspiration for people to go, hey, you know, we could do this.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead, we had a very disjointed anarchist movement that didn't really know what it wanted or where it was going.
Yep.
And here's the other side of that same coin. Since the state had not come to its maturity, if you went to someone, okay, now I have to make an exception to this rule. If you take out two events, one in Europe and one in... take out three events. If you take out of what I'm about to say, remove the Napoleonic Wars, remove the so-called American Civil War,
mm-hmm.
which was not a civil war,
mm-mm.
and if you remove the Boer Wars,
they were a bore anyway.
Yeah, these were three horribly, horribly brutal manifestations of the state. But if you take them out of the mix.
And even they could not even compare to the horrors that the state was about to unleash onto the world.
Exactly. But most people didn't know what happened in those three wars.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take those three things out of the mix, and you take an average person who didn't actually see the Napoleonic Wars taking place, didn't actually see the American Civil War taking place,
yep.
and didn't actually see the Boer War taking place, Boer Wars, because it was a series, but anyway... And if you set them down and you explain to them, this is what the state will bring you. Millions of people, millions, lined up and slaughtered en masse in not one place, but multiple places around the world, constantly for 100 years. This is what the state's about to bring you.
They wouldn't believe it.
No way. They would say, you're nuts. You're crazy.
Yeah.
The state is here to help us. The state's organizing business. The state's codifying laws.
Yep.
None of those things. That's all a lie.
And part of it, and really quick, is that it's very difficult for people to be anarchists during a boom.
Exactly.
During a recession, it's very easy to point out and go, they're evil, look at what they're doing.
Yeah.
But when... technology and when industry is exploding and the government is having a really hard time controlling it,
yeah,
and everybody's getting rich and the economics are going crazy,
yeah,
and it's really hard to point out to people, this is bad, see what they're doing,
yeah,
because
people don't see the evils of the state until they feel the evils of the state.
Yeah.
And that's what we didn't have in 1900. Nobody, very, very few people knew exactly the depths of the evil,
yep,
of what this thing was that was being birthed on us. And now we think we have an idea, but I'm telling you what, we don't.
No.
We don't. It's not here yet.
No.
All we're seeing is that baby dragon. And it's just starting to put its big boy boots on and stomp around.
The horrors that happened in... Well, when you compare the horrors that happened in the Civil War to the horrors, mm-hmm, that happened in World War II,
yeah,
that's what we're about to see.
Yeah. Because... That dramatic, yeah, increase.
That we're about to... And it may not happen tomorrow. It,
right,
may not happen,
right,
in the next 100 years. But it will get to the point where the state is doing such horrible things,
yeah,
that looking back on the horrors of what happened in World War II,
right,
will be nothing.
Yeah.
That will be nothing.
And all you have to do is think about this. If you think about what one state could do, Cambodia, Soviet Union, mm-hmm, Nazi Germany, you just take one example of what one state can do. That's just one state. What if there were one state?
Right.
What if this thing got itself to become one worldwide state, rather than fighting against itself constantly?
And people say, oh, that couldn't possibly happen. Really? Really? Because it's happening
Europe. Yeah.
Right now. The European Union is basically Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, it's becoming one state throughout all of Europe.
And they did it in the United States.
And we're moving that direction.
There were individual states in the United States,
yeah,
and it became one state.
And we're moving that direction with the North American Union, mm-hmm, at this time. And Brazil is moving in that direction with its association with India, mm-hmm, and China. And you're going to see these things come together, and it's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse. And we have to be independent individuals to avoid this.
Yep.
All right, we've run, right, even with an hour, we still ran way over. Can you believe that?
Oh,
I'm sorry, folks. We really tried to get this in at an hour, but
anyway.
So steampunk.
Steampunk. It's really cool.
Copper, brass.
Goggles and gears and pocket watches. It's very nifty.
Thanks very much, folks. We really appreciate the emails that you send and the feedback on the website. It's really encouraging to read the emails and it's clumsy because you want to say letters, but it's not letters. We don't do letters. What are you from, 1940?
And also thanks to LouRockwell.com for the shout out.
Oh yeah, that was huge. Thanks Lou. Thanks to Lou Rockwell for that. We got a spot on the Lou Rockwell blog, and that was really cool.
Yep.
So, oh, and I got an email back that said, who's that guy on the right side of the splash page on badquaker.com? And I'm like, oh, that'd be me. I'm the real life bad Quaker with the whole a bit hairy. Folks, thanks a lot for listening to us. Be sure and check back with us next Wednesday for another podcast. If you don't like us going an hour, be sure and tell us.
Yep.
So, till then, I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.